Welcome to the Open House podcast site, available at openhousecommunity.com.au.
After dedicating his professional life to the study of the incredible complexities of the human brain, Dr. William Struthers compares men's brains in particular to that of a high-definition TV receiver. As much as many wives and girlfriends may hold to a contrary view, there are some images that only take a second or two to actually begin to rewire a man's brain. In his book, Wired for Intimacy, Wheaton University's Professor of Psychology, Dr. Struthers, explores the impact of sexual imagery on real intimacy. And he joined us on Open House recently, where we began our conversation outlining how to steer clear of sexual images and pornography when they're so pervasive.
Well, that's a great question, because historically pornography has been thought of as sort of the lowest grade of art form that's out there, because the naked human body gets your attention, whether you want it to or not.
Yeah.
But the naked human body is not always engaged in stimulating someone to sexual arousal. So, for example, a naked child, the majority of people look at a naked child and they don't think anything about it. Or even, for example, a picture in a medical book. You know, here's the human body, these are the different parts, and of course it needs to be shown naked because you need to be able to see all the different parts of the human body. But as far as sexual signals, and this is where I think it's really important that we move from the depiction of the nude image to people or human beings, parts of the body, the way that we sexualize human beings. There's something about how we sexualize signals and pick it up, because you can have a picture of someone who's dressed in yoga pants, or, they're showing a lot of cleavage, or they're in a bathing suit, and it can be sexualized. But you can also have someone who's in their bathing suit who's just sort of on the beach, hanging out with their friends, and it not be sexualized either. So there's two major factors. One is how much skin is being shown, and the other is going to be, what is the person engaged in doing? So how are we viewing the context? Is this where someone is just sort of standing there, just sort of looking out into the ocean, or is it a picture or a video that is designed to try to titillate? And you do see that there's this wide spectrum, and I think what we found is that as a culture, we've kind of moved from one end where we're overly Victorian and not wanting to see any skin at all, and we've now gone to the place where we've sort of crossed over the middle line, and we're now going to the place where, you can see sexual images pretty much, on a daily basis, whether it be in advertisements or on television.
Are men and women equally vulnerable to an addiction to pornography?
They are, but in different ways. So when we look at the way that men are neurologically wired, they, for the most part, have a visual entry system. So this is not to say that all men are exclusively visual, but it would be silly, I think, to suggest that men are not visually sensitive to cues. And so men, pornography, when they look at it online, it sort of activates a system that's really easy to activate. It's already there. Whereas women, on the other hand, are a little more contextual. That is, they not that women don't appreciate the visual, but they tend to be much more interested in the context and as the entry point, which is why they read romance novels historically. And so when you look at neurologically what's going on, when you live in a sexualized culture, men have this Achilles heel for the pornography. So it's easy for the sexualized culture to get its hooks into them. But with women, what you're finding is that they're being groomed into pornography, and they're being groomed into what we would call a very masculine style of sexual imagery as triggering the arousal. So it's not really surprising that we're seeing more and more younger women who are now acting out the bad behavior that you would expect from men. So more and more women now are growing up in the sexualized culture, whereas men, it's easy to exploit them. Women are now being exploited, but just in a different way.
Bill, I'm intrigued by what allows one person to come in contact with pornography and move on with their life, and another who falls prey to an addiction.
Well, I think what you're getting at is a really interesting concept that neuroscientists would refer to this as neuroplasticity. So much of what we're seeing with individuals who are involved in what we would call pornography addiction is because they've sort of trained their brain to respond in such a way that after, viewing it and acting out and viewing it and acting out and viewing it and acting out, what we're seeing is that there are circuits in their brains, and there are parts of their brains that are actually shrinking and are correlated with this. And there's a study that came out last week.
I saw this research.
Yeah,
yeah.
The, it's suggested that, well, you know, as pornography viewing goes up, these parts of the brain and these circuits in the brain become smaller. They become less active. And it's sort of a chicken or the egg question. Is, well, are people who have smaller brains or weaker circuits more prone to developing pornography addictions? And that's a legitimate claim to make and very possible. That may be the case. But I think it gets to this bigger question, which is sex actually is something that becomes learned. It's something that we develop affinities, we develop appetites, we develop tastes for, as I mentioned earlier, fetishes. And the decisions that we make and how we respond to sexual cues are incredibly important, because you know, people will joke about, well, one person's heterosexual, or one person's homosexual, one person's bisexual. I sometimes will joke that I'm donisexual, which is I'm actually so tuned into my wife that I can appreciate the beauty of other women and even see these images that I would say are clearly pornography, clearly sexualized, and they don't arouse me in the same way. So the manner in which we exercise our sexuality like a muscle, or, you know, strengthens that circuit, strengthens that muscle in such a way that we can actually direct our preferences, so that when we see pornography or we see sexualized images, it's actually for you to step back and say, that doesn't really arouse me anymore because of my own sexual history and the way that I've exercised, what I would say faithful love and affection for my wife. So when we stop and think about sex in that way, it's a very different way than people would think.
When we speak of a pornography addiction, are we speaking of an addiction to pictures or the high that comes from looking at them?
It's both, because the pictures will be the thing that produces the high. So when you look at addiction, one way to use that we've obviously in the use of addiction language is to use that sort of drug abuse language.
Yes.
And I think it's very helpful for people to step back and say, well, you can use a drug when the drug is the best way to give you the result that you're looking for. So if I've got an infection, I'll take an antibiotic. But I wouldn't really take an antibiotic if I wanted to get, you know, incredible muscles, like to get like a six pack of abdominal muscles or something like that. Yeah. So I'd actually be misusing the drug. But the drug doesn't hurt me, and I might be silly for doing that. But if I take antibiotics over and over and over and over, whether it's to try to get that six pack of muscles, my immune system is going to be compromised. So now I'm actually abusing the drug. It's damaging me. And so just like with alcohol, you can use alcohol to, you know, make a piece of red meat taste better. Mm-hmm. But you can also misuse alcohol by drinking to avoid a problem. But when you're consuming so much alcohol that you're damaging your body, you're damaging your relationships, we would call that abuse. But it doesn't, the student at uni who goes out on Friday night and drinks themselves to oblivion and throws up, they're actually abusing the alcohol, but we wouldn't call them an alcoholic.
No.
And so for the pornography addict, many pornography addicts really start out actually misusing pornography to medicate other parts of their lives. And then what happens is as they continually misuse, they move into abuse. And some individuals, not everyone, but some individuals get into this really difficult pattern where they find themselves spiraling out of control and they end up becoming what we would call pornography addicts.
Okay, so now we come to the subject of rerouting the rerouted brain. How does that take place?
Well, basically, you follow the same rules of neuroplasticity that got you to that place of addiction. So as you've trained yourself into becoming a pornography abuser or a pornography addict, well, you have to find different behaviors to engage in. You have to find different ways of meeting those needs that you were using the pornography to, you were misusing the pornography to help satisfy those needs of, you know, dealing with your depression or dealing with your anxiety. And most pornography addicts don't really even know why they're using the pornography. And they get to a place where they just fall into kind of despair because they don't know why they're using it. And so when you get to that place of discovering what are the keys, what are the triggers, what are the red flags, so to speak, and you change your behavior, the changing of the behavior and redirecting the sexual energy in an appropriate way towards your spouse, we'll say, or refraining from sexually acting out, or finding a way to redirect your sexual energy to, you know, I like to joke with students, some of the best sonnets and musical pieces that have ever been written were because someone had unrequited, you know, sexual affection for someone. So finding better ways, more productive ways, more healthy ways of channeling your sexual energy will be that part, will be that process of rewiring, of creating these different connections that will become the preferred healthy patterns that you have, as opposed to the maladaptive addictive patterns.
I'm intrigued by your use of the term pornography abusers, which in other conversations, the word abuse would indicate that whatever we're talking about has some sort of purpose outside of its abuse. What is the appropriate use for porn?
And that's a great question. That's one that I get when I define it in this way oftentimes. I would argue that there's really no appropriate use for pornography, that pornography inherently takes something that should be sacred, which is a sexually intimate moment between two people, and it broadcasts it. Well, you don't broadcast sacred intimate moments. And so even the language of pornography use, well, people will often say, well, what about pornography to kind of spice up my, you know, my sex life with my spouse, or maybe I need to learn some new moves or something like that. Well, human beings are pretty creative. I don't think we kind of got by without pornography for the better part of human history. I don't think that, and I'm pretty sure those moves were then as well as they are now. So thinking about, you know, if you really want to learn some more moves, or you want to spice some things up with your wife, you know, to say, look, I need to look at another woman having sex with another man in order to find you attractive, to me, inherently undermines that relationship. Or to say, look, I'd want to try something new. How about talking about what you'd like to try? Or how about, you know, the two of you sort of creatively exploring? And I think that's a beautiful thing about sexuality, is that when two people are coming together and discovering something kind of together, it can be really beautiful. Whereas if they view something in porn, you say, look, I want you to do that because it looks like it's really good and I want to try and see it and how it feels. To me, well, now it's kind of, we're objectifying people, and we're saying, you as my spouse or you as my sexual partner, you need to try a little bit harder. And we need to kind of, you know, see if you can perform like this person performs. And sex is not about performing, but even the language that we use in today's world, the way we talk about sex carries this performance language to it. And, you know, that you have, sexual performance drugs or like Viagra or something
performance
like that.
Performance anxiety.
Exactly. Yeah. So it's, I mean, sex is not a performance. It's an intimate space.
Bill, as a neuroscientist, you've spoken eloquently about the brain changes that come from a pornography addiction, but I know that you're also a man of faith. What's the role of faith in recovery?
Well, I think that what I would say is sexual issues have a significant spiritual component to them. And when you look at people who kind of map out the spirituality in the brain, what we find is there's a great amount of overlap of spirituality in the brain with sexuality in the brain. So it's not surprising, and you see this in other religions as well, not just Christianity. So when there's a sexual problem or there's sexual shaming, it affects a person spiritually. And when a person is in a good place sexually, it means that they're, you know, they can often have a much easier time of getting to a good place spiritually as well. So when it comes to matters of faith, and I'll talk more specifically about the porn addicts here, is, you know, if the sole goal of the porn addict is just to refrain from bad sexual behavior, well, what happens is faith creates a higher ceiling for that person to recover. Okay. It's not just about refraining from doing bad. It's rightly understanding where sexuality fits within your religious system or fits within, you know, your faith system, so that you say, well, you know, sex is a God-given gift. It's a wonderful thing. And it can be something that can really kind of cause me to come together with my wife or with my husband or whoever it is. And the spiritual ceiling is sort of broken, and you can go to much higher highs with faith than you can without it. But in the same way, the faith can also cause you to go to deeper lows as well. Yeah. What we're seeing is more and more people who are who view these problems as inherently religious can go to deeper places of addiction than those who aren't.
Bill, let's wrap our conversation with some how-to tips for listeners who are impacted right now by a pornography addiction, starting with those who are actually enmeshed in this web. How do I begin to break free?
Well, I think the first thing that you need to do is you need to find someone safe that you can disclose this to. One of the things about sexual addiction is that it isolates people. And once they're isolated, they become more and more prone to going deeper down into the addiction. So finding a safe person, for some of you, that may be your pastor. For some of you, it may be a friend. And I would say once you find that person, you know, if they may say, well, I'm not the person that can kind of help you with this, they'll pass you along. But you have to take that first step of disclosing this and revealing this to a safe individual. For those of you who are married and are considering disclosing it to your wife, I would want to say perhaps your spouse is not the best person to disclose it to. That would be, they, unless they're a you know, someone who specializes in this area, they're probably not going to be the person who's going to be able to help you plot out what those next steps are. So finding a safe person who will not judge you that you can disclose to will be step one. After that, then it's going to vary from person to person. Okay. But what I would want to say is that the brain science behind neuroplasticity and the realities that your decisions, in fact, do matter and they do change you, is the message of hope, that the very same rules that governed how you got to this place of addiction are the same rules that will get you back to a healthy place and probably even to a better place than you could have imagined.
Bill, could we turn to the partner of one who's addicted to porn? What's your message for them?
Well, to the partner, the first thing that I would say is, it's probably not about you. I think too often partners will find out that their loved one is viewing and dabbling or has kind of this kind of problem. And immediately what they do is they turn it in on themselves and maybe think that it's something wrong with them, that they can't satisfy their partner. And so what I would want to say is, it's probably not about you. It's most likely not about you. It's definitely not about you. It's about this individual. And so to free themselves up from sort of the self-shaming that goes when you discover that someone close to you is dabbling in pornography or caught up in it, I would say, you know, the best way to love them is to call them to a standard of integrity, to say, look, you need to go get someone to help you out with this, and I'm probably not the person who's going to be able to do it. But to not take it personally, to encourage them to go out and then to cooperate with them in the process, to you know, if they do need to change the way that their lives are sort of altered in the way that they get rid of the internet, or that if they want to do what's best for their partner, then sometimes that will mean that there are some sacrifices that they need to make. But it's not about them. It's not their fault.
Dr. Bill Struthers, we mentioned at the beginning of this conversation, it was a sensitive subject, but it's an explosive one all the same.
I agree.
Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed this Open House podcast. To hear more from Open House, visit openhousecommunity.com.au.